I like that. Yeah, thank you. That was worth waiting for, I just want to say. All right. I just wanted to get a sense of this. We're kind of running out of time, so I want to go on to the next letter. But the right. So if you come out of meditation with a less anxious presence, then you're more likely to actually help the person in front of you, for example. And ironically, of course, it's walking in the woods late at night where C.S. Lewis has his conversion with the Inklings. He's converted to Christianity on a long walk in the woods where the boundaries, the protective boundaries that he's had up intellectually are kind of washed away just by his experience of God in the woods. All right. So the next is on humility. In this letter, Screwtape is concerned because Wormwood's patient has discovered real humility. Screwtape tells Wormwood to draw the patient's attention to himself and to just how humble he is being. I love that. I'm going to intervene here to say if anybody ever says they're humble, they're not. As the patient becomes proud of his newfound humility and false modesty, the actual virtue of humility becomes worthless and becomes susceptible to temptation. I'm thinking that you've seen this, at least in other people, often enough not to have to talk about this for a long period of time, but I do want to focus on one thing Screwtape says in the letter. The enemy, God, wants to bring the man to a state of mind in which he could design the best cathedral in the world and know it to be the best and rejoice in that fact without being any more or less or otherwise glad at having done it than he would be if it had been done by another. You with me on that? You could so admire something that you did and yet not be any more impressed than you would be if it had been done by somebody else. Can you get a sense of what that might feel like? I read a book once where I, no. So my question of you is, can you remember a time when you rejoiced at your neighbors having achieved something that you had tried unsuccessfully to do? Your neighbor having achieved something you tried unsuccessfully to do, yes. Right, yes. I was, when the Olympics were here, I was running down along we used to call it Collins Drive there down along the river. And I was at the end of my 15 miles or whatever. And I mean, all I could hear was my heavy feet slamming against the ground. And all of a sudden there was this and one of the Kenyan runners was out there training. And I mean, he went by me with strides as long as this row of chairs, his head on a solid. And so, yeah, you were just overwhelmed with the beauty of that. So then my question is that easier than when it's just me who beats you? You with me? Like, it's easier for me to admire the Kenyan than it would be my friend who outsprinted me at the end of whatever it was. Maybe. But the closer it gets, or you were angling for a promotion at work and you didn't get it when you thought you should have, but your neighbor did, and everybody wants to have a party to celebrate their success. Is that fun for you? Is it fun for you? It should be. Yeah. That's what C.S. Lewis is saying. That's humility when it is. Yes. Holding on to your experience in the cocoon. Yes. So, I mean, I was playing golf with a couple of guys about a month ago, and I just kind of stopped at one moment, and I thought, this is so much fun. Because everybody is so excited about other people's success. That isn't always the case, right? It's like, that was a good putt for your fourth one. I don't know what to say. But everybody was so excited for other people to be successful that it was just fun. And ironically, you played better golf when that's true. But that's the point, I think, where C.S. Lewis is trying to carve out for us this notion that our excitement about others doesn't, we're not getting into that invidious comparison about what it says about us. We're simply recognizing beauty and being excited about it. All right, we are sadly coming to the end of our time. Here in letter 15, he talks about time and eternity. So what he says is we have this great tendency to either focus on the past or focus on the future and not be present. And this is what's interesting. Screwtape says, If you have to choose, get them focused on the present. Because in the past, there's some experience of grace that they may remember. But they'll never be in the future because it's just worry that animates their fantasies about the future. This is another spiritual practice, I think, just to be, we talk about being in the present all the time, but the truth is we're often worried about what happened in the past or anxious about what happens in the future. I've just finished traveling with my wife, and if I learn nothing else, it's that she is fearless about missing the plane. Fearless. And the truth is she doesn't care. She's like, if we miss the plane, there's another flight. And I, like 3 hours before, am worried about missing the plane. I'm like, it's time to get up. Have you got your backpack? What about the credit card? So this is just kind of interesting. And finally, I'm like, well, I guess if we miss the plane, we miss the plane. We sat on the plane for 20 minutes, but I was worried about it. Do you worry more about the past or the future, and why? Don't have to answer now, but the idea is that to be attuned to whether you habitually get trapped in the past or in the future, and to take Screwtape's advice, if you will, that getting trapped in the future is a real trap because there's less of God there. It's because it's constructed by ourselves and our own fears and worries. We really talked a lot about church and the idea of feeling at church. So I want to go to gluttony. In this letter, Screwtape helps Wormwood understand the sin of gluttony as something that's still alive. In fact, just as alive today as it always was, but with a new modern twist. This mutated form of gluttony is not necessarily about how much a person eats, but rather about being controlled by what one eats. The control often manifests itself in the form of inconvenient demands on others. So we're back to my notion of ego as control or expectation, which I loved. I've told that anyway. So the point here is gluttony is not just about quantity. It's not just about taking on too much. It's about losing your self-control. So then we go to the patient's mother. Screwtape says about the patient's mother, she is always turning from what has been offered to her to say with a demure little sigh and a smile, "Oh, please, please. All I want," these are the words to worry about, "all I want is a cup of tea, weak but not too weak, and the teeniest, weeniest bit of really crisp toast." You see? Would that have struck you as gluttonous? I was watching an episode of Frasier. I think it was Frasier, but who's the, there's a character in Frasier whose name escapes me at the moment. There's another show with he and his brother. He's very precise about everything, very precious about everything. And the two of them were in a coffee shop. And when the server came over to ask them what they would like, they spent 20 minutes describing the latte that they wanted. And fundamentally, the description could be summarized simply by saying that every ingredient they wanted it less of it. Like, we don't want whole milk, we want soy milk. We don't want this, we want that. You're with me, right? This took forever. It was hilarious, and you're just like. The waitress listens patiently to all this, turns to the barista and says, "Two gutless wonders, please." But at least in my life, which is full of people who love food, this comes up all the time. And you're in some restaurant and you go, "I know you've, you know, cooked the lobster this way, but could you like cook it another way?" And we go, "No, they've already cooked the lobster." It's a different way to think about gluttony is you try to control, right, every little bit of what it is, which is really a critique of the way it's otherwise been prepared, which leaves you in control while seemingly humble. That's C.S. Lewis's claim, I think. So I actually think this works just fine in my own life, and you can maybe find it in yours, right? How many modifications do you see, and why are they there? All right. Well, I want to offer you two practices to consider for the week. And one is to make a short list of your real positive pleasures. Now, real positive pleasures, that's the label that C.S. Lewis gave to walking in the woods and reading the book. I would say really experiencing something about life without attempting to instrumentalize it, without judging it as good or bad, without thinking about it in terms of what it will do for you or won't do for you. Right? Just enjoying being alive. Walk in the woods, read a good book, without judging it or instrumentalizing it. So make a list of those things and make time during the week to do them. And then reflect on Lewis's idea that they are touchstones of reality. That often we think about reality as, well, you got to get to the bad stuff or it's not real. But no, that's not all of reality. A lot of reality is wonderful. And we're missing it by worrying about it. So start small. Sometimes I say to people who are really in great stress or pain, just find the smallest thing that feels pleasurable to you and do it. If it's the hot water in the shower in the morning, that's a good place to start. Because finding that bit of pleasure for its own sake will be the beginning of your healing. This is very pragmatic. It's not just a grand spiritual design. Think of real positive pleasures and make sure you do them. I don't know if you've ever tried to work out something like a rule of life, but I did, and by the time I finished all the things I ought to do every day, it was very clear that even if I was in a monastery, there wouldn't be enough time, right? There are all these things to be done, and all I'm saying is, in that ordering of your week, take some time for something that's what C.S. Lewis would call a real positive pleasure. All right, option B. For meditators. So here you go. A lot of meditation, single point meditation, will be you can focus on your breathing or whatever other kind of mantra you might have or single point of attention, but invariably it's designed for you to let go of your thoughts. Try not to think with me, even if you don't meditate. You see what I'm saying? So the idea is you get this thought because there's a constant stream of thoughts in your mind, right? A constant stream. And you just don't get attached to any of it, right? But the first thing you do is you don't get attached to it, so you don't really observe it, and you don't really name it. And if you've got to go get your kids from Godly Play, please feel free to go. So this, if you do that, then this week try a different kind of meditation, which is note the emotions when they crop up. So you don't have to be a meditator here. Just note the emotions as you walk through your week. So I feel afraid, I feel angry, I feel sad. Just make a note of them, notice them, and try to figure out what might lie beneath them. Notice how they're often directly related to the particular strategies of behavior that you use to cope with everyday life. For example, if your basic strategy is to be in control, I know that's nobody in here. If your basic strategy is to be in control, you might notice how much of your thinking takes the form of planning. This is similar to my comment about the future, right? When I'm feeling an emotion of anxiety or fear or sadness and note it, how often is that related to planning? I hope you can see how very simply, by paying attention to your life, you can begin to get insight into yourself and your own willingness or unwillingness to leave your cocoon. That makes sense? All right. I look forward to seeing you next week. Go in peace to love and serve the Lord.